Welcome to Creative Maine, an hour-long monthly program produced for and broadcast by WERU 89.9 FM Blue Hill, Maine, and at weru.org. This show considers the making of craft, fine art, food, literature, music, dance, museums, and any other form of creative expression here in Maine. We also discuss topics of global cultural significance and interest. My name is Adina Salmonson, and I am your host for this monthly exploration of all things creative. Should you have comments, questions, input, or suggestions for the show, send them to info@weru.org. Please list Creative Maine in the subject line. The life of the arts is a test of the quality of a nation's civilization, said JFK. As a lifelong musician and crafter, I am thrilled to be presenting my areas of interest and passion to you on our wonderful community radio station right here in my Orland backyard. On today's episode, we investigate the very main art and craft of sugaring and speak to Jason Lilly, the maple industry educator from the University of Maine, Ron Russell, former District 17 representative and Verona Island sugarer. We also speak with several folks out and about enjoying Maine Maple Weekend. And in a very special segment, we honor April as National Poetry Month in an interview with Maine's Poet Laureate, Julia Bausma. Welcome, Jason Lilly, to Creative Maine. I'm so happy that you could be here today and talk to our listeners a little bit about maple sugaring. You are the Sustainable Agriculture and Maple Industry Educator at University of Maine, and I would love to hear a little bit more about that. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background and what led you to this position at University of Maine? It sounds very, very interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks for having me. So I work specifically with the Cooperative Extension, and in case your listeners aren't aware, the Cooperative Extension is a branch of the university, and our mission is to take research and evidence-based information and to kind of translate that into a format that we can be shared with the community. So we have the 4-H program, which is youth development. We have a team that does nutrition and food safety education and outreach and research. We do the Master Gardener program and offer support for gardeners who may be having issues or want suggestions and advice related to garden management. And I am on the team that does outreach to the commercial agricultural community. So I'm based in Southern Maine for the sustainable agriculture part, where I work with farmers in Cumberland, Androscoggin, and Sagadahoc counties and help them with business management. Primarily soils management is really my passion and interest. And really any question that comes in that farmers may have, we either answer that or get them connected with relevant and reliable resources.
Great. So with the maple sugaring, you do that mostly further north?
Yeah, so that is a statewide role that I have. And we have maple producers throughout the entire state. In kind of coastal southern Maine, we have a lot of smaller producers, but still at a scale that they're selling syrup to, retail. Mm-hmm. And then in the northern part of the state, we have a mix, but there's significantly more very large producers up there. So along the Quebec border in the North Maine woods and up in the Jackman area, we have a lot of producers that are over 30,000 up to 200,000 taps in a single operation. So because of those operations, Somerset County is the largest producer of maple syrup of an individual county in the U.S.
My goodness. Okay. Yeah. And that's saying something, because there's a lot of sugaring operations along the northern border. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of sugaring and sugaring in Maine specifically? When did it get started?
So I'll put a caveat on all of this that I am not a member of tribal or indigenous communities. So this is information that I've gathered from conversations and resources. But my understanding is that the practice of collecting maple sap and concentrating it down into either sugar or maple syrup goes back to prehistoric times, as long as we have information and kind of written records. So the theories that I've heard are that folks were cooking, say meat or cooking something down under a tree in the springtime, and it could have been that there was a broken branch on a maple tree, or that some squirrels had chewed on some maple buds, and the sap was dripping out of the tree down into the vessel that was cooking, or onto the meat that was cooking. And in that process, it thickened up and it added those sugars to the meat. And that's when folks recognized that there was something very sweet and very valuable that was coming out of those maple trees. So through time, the tribal communities would make notches into the tree, whether that was a slash with a hatchet, or just something to open up the bark of the tree. And then if they stuck a branch or just a little twig, that would allow the sap to run down that twig and fall into a birch bark bowl or some type of vessel where they could collect that liquid and then transport it into another vessel where they could concentrate that down.
Wow.
Of course, pre-colonial times, there was no cast iron in North America. So the theory around that is that they would make a hollowing in a tree. So they would take a down tree and make like a indentation in it, so they could pour the sap into that big trough, and then put rocks that had been in a fire into the sap. So instead of the fire going through the tree, the heat was added through the rocks into the sap, and that's how they would boil it down.
I know that's how a lot of cooking was done. Yeah.
And of course, the idea of moving maple syrup around and the having containers that would seal and be airtight, and all that was really pretty difficult. Another aspect of maple syrup is that as we're making it today, we're shooting for a very precise sugar concentration. If it's not concentrated enough, it could mold. And if it's concentrated too far, then these sugar crystals like settle out, and it's kind of a weird thing to work with. So, as opposed to trying to make maple syrup, generally speaking, folks would just take that syrup and continue to remove the water from it until it created a sugar cake or crystallized sugar.
So much the way sugarcane was processed.
And you can still, a lot of producers will make granulated maple sugar today, and it's really good. It has that amount of sweetness, but also has that maple flavor that comes through with it.
I do. I bake with it and put it on pancakes. It's fantastic. So maple syrup is a big business anymore. It's become the flagship product of places like Vermont, for example, and also in Canada, there are a lot of, the maple leaf is on their flag, So you can get syrup pretty much anywhere. So on a day like Maine Maple Sunday, we go to the actual producers to purchase right from them. Share your thoughts on what may have been lost or gained because maple products are more big business and no longer strictly a local commodity.
As you alluded to, there are very large markets. There are a handful of very large packers that buy syrup in bulk. And one benefit of that is that as we, get towards the end of our seasons and it's warmer outside and we're more likely to make poor, like off, well, I'll say off flavored syrups.
Okay.
That is a thing that happens in the industry, and producers are aware that we can't have off-flavored syrups on the retail market. People don't want sour syrup on their pancakes. So the benefit of having these big packers is that they can have relationships with food manufacturers and places that make barbecue sauces and dog food, and still have an outlet so that producers can get paid for the syrup that is off grade like that. Yeah, the downside is that just like many things, too many things in our food system these days, you lose that connection to the way that the food was made and the understanding of what that food is, but also the huge kind of disruption in the flow of the money around that product and the negative impact to the local economies at times. I was part of an economic analysis study for the Maine maple industry in 2022, and we know that the maple industry existing contributes $55 million to the Maine economy. So if we start to take a lot of that and ship it out of state and even out of country, we start to lose and chip away at some of that direct economic impact. The other side of going to Costco, and that's a great example, is that a lot of times those large buyers are looking to buy syrup at the lowest price possible. And those packers don't always care like where the syrup of what quality goes to. And I've had some really terrible syrup from some of these large box stores. So when you're going directly to the local producers and you're getting to see the sugar house or see the farm, those producers are really putting a high quality on or a high value on the quality of the product that they're selling you, and you're much more likely to get a better, more high quality product.
I imagine that would have some sort of impact on tourism as well. If you can only get real maple syrup in a place like Maine or Vermont, or in some cases Wisconsin, that's where you'll go.
Right. And yeah, that draws people in. Here in Maine, I work a lot with the Maine Maple Producers Association. So we just had our Maine Maple Sunday, and folks are reporting record numbers for attendance and turnout. And it's one of those things that everyone looks forward to. It's delicious food, delicious smells, and it's that opportunity to get out and be part of the community as we're slowly climbing out of the winter and being holed up at home. So we have that. We have the Fall Maple Fest. So that's usually around Indigenous Peoples Weekend. There's fewer sugar houses that are participating in that, but again, it's a great opportunity to be part of and get connected to the maple industry.
What happens in the fall with maple sugaring?
So if you've been out hiking or driving around, you know that as you're looking out at the foliage, it's really maple trees that are the predominant, like bright orange, bright red, that are bringing a lot of those colors. So it's kind of an opportunity to get folks out and to catch some of those leaf peepers that are coming in from out of state just to see the leaves. But it's also a way to highlight very different uses of syrup. So put some maple syrup in your apple crisp, and put a little splash in with your hot cocoa, or some of those fall flavors are really well complemented with some of that additional maple flavor in there.
Gotcha. Okay. So, what do you see coming? What do you see in the days ahead? It occurred to me that rapid global climate change, of course, is having an impact on our local ways of doing things because things are not timed the way they used to be. What do you see about rapid global climate change that will impact the practice and the business of maple sugaring here in Maine?
Yeah, so this is something that I'm definitely working hard on, and we have a new project to do education for sugar bush managers on how to increase the resilience of their sugar bush against extreme weather. Maple production has always been very, very at the whims of Mother Nature, and it has to be up into that high 30s range at least for the sap to start flowing. It has to get down below freezing to reset the trees and to have additional sap flow through the season. And if it warms up too much, it affects the quality. If it warms up too much for too long, it shuts the season down. So that fluctuation and being totally dependent on the weather throughout the season is always a little nerve-wracking. And then to see those fluctuations change and get more extreme really has a lot of folks nervous.
I would imagine, yeah.
What is maybe a bigger issue is during the growing season when the trees have leaves on and they're actually producing those carbohydrates and the starches that will come out in the future as sweet sap. As we have extremely warm weathers or droughts or saturated soils from too much rain, that all decreases the health of the trees, and that's where we're putting a lot of our focus and effort into.
Very good. Please give our Creative Maine listeners who may like to learn more from you and the knowledge that the Extension program has to offer some resources for research, reading, listening, so forth. What do you suggest?
Absolutely. So we are available. Our phone lines are open. So you can reach out to Extension at any time with questions. We have locations in pretty much every county throughout the state. So whether it's gardening questions, food preservation, or maple questions, you can definitely give us a call and we're happy to speak with folks. We also have a maple production resource hub on the Extension, the UMaine Extension website. So I have some videos and a lot of fact sheets on how to get started with making maple syrup in the backyard, the equipment that you need, and then some business resources if you want to get into this as a business, the licenses and all those types of things.
Very good. Do you have a URL for us?
So that can be found at extension.umaine.edu. / maple - syrup - production.
Wow.
And also that comes up pretty easily with a Google search. I
So,
also work with the Maine Maple Producers Association and the Southern Maine Maple Sugar Makers Association. And those groups are really great for peer-to-peer learning and getting connected with resources. So I'd encourage folks to reach out to those groups if you're interested in getting into this in a bigger way.
excellent. Thank you so much. This has been very interesting. And now that maple season is drawing down, I'm sure that you're busy with the gardening aspect of your job. But I appreciate you taking the time and coming on to talk with us today. Thank you so much, Jason.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Creative Maine is alive with activities, presentations, workshops, concerts, and all manner of cultural endeavor. At this point in the show, we highlight a few of the many calendar items going on around our region. The Bangor Band joins forces with the University of Maine Collegiate Chorale and the Acadia Choral Society to celebrate Earth Day, April 22nd at 7 p.m. at Peaks Auditorium in Bangor High School. This free program is an exciting, family-friendly way to honor Mother Earth. For more information, visit bangorband.org. Our Maine Poet Laureate will be featured throughout the National Poetry Month of April all around Maine. On April 25th from 2 to 3 p.m., Julia Bausma will read from her book, Midden, together with a discussion about Malaga Island history at the Merrill Memorial Library in Yarmouth. She will also offer a poetry reading on April 29th at the Rumford Public Library at 6:30 p.m. The Maine Forest and Logging Museum will showcase and interpret its award-winning fish ladder on Alewife Day, Saturday, May 17th at 262 Government Road in Bradley, Maine. For more information, write to info@maineforestandloggingmuseum.org. For a more complete listing of events, visit our website, weru.org, and click the Community Calendar tab. If you would like to add an item to the Community Calendar, you may follow the prompts on the calendar page and submit your own event for the list. If you have an event that you feel is particularly pertinent to Creative Maine, send a note with the details to info@weru.org and list Creative Maine in the subject line. You are listening to Creative Maine on WERU 89.9 FM and on weru.org. Now, we speak to some visitors of the Back Ridge Sugar Shack on Maine Maple Sunday, as well as discuss maple syrup experiences and ruminations with Representative Ron Russell. So who am I talking to? What's your name?
Lorelei.
Lorelei, where do you live, Lorelei?
Herman.
Herman, very good. What a beautiful day, right? Isn't it a pretty day to taste something sweet?
Yeah.
So what did you go into? Did you go into the sugar house today?
Yes. I learned how you make maple syrup.
Do you think you could go and be an apprentice and make some maple syrup now?
Yeah.
I am here talking to Ron Russell of Verona Island, who many of you may know as our former District 17 representative to the State House. And he has, to his credit, many, many achievements. But in addition to everything else, he is a maple sugar maker. And so, Ron, welcome to Creative Maine. And tell us a little bit about yourself and how an automobile authority and former state representative comes to run a sugar shack.
Well, I would say that probably the biggest reason I came to it is my wife Jean and I, are surrounded by maple trees on our farm on Verona Island. We bought our farm here in 1979, so been here ever since. So, you know, we're interested in growing things and using what we can off the farm, and that started a long time ago. Jean had a business here for a number of years. She did wedding flowers and used almost exclusively the flowers that we grew. So,
wow.
And then when the kids were young with some other parents and kids around, they started a 4-H club, and so they had sheep and things like that. Even though I went off work for the Darlings family, which I did for 42 years. You know, it was a great career, great family. I was really happy that I did it. You know, my heart was here on the farm. So early on, the kids, you know, when they were young, they wanted to, hey, Dad, let's make some maple syrup. So there were some fairly good-sized maple trees. And we only have red maples. We don't have any sugar maple trees, which means you have to work harder because it takes about 55 gallons of red maple sap to make a gallon of syrup, and it's only 40 if you have sugar maples. Red maples is what we had, so I found a great big old stainless steel pot, probably held 25 gallons. And so we built a little stone fireplace out in the middle of the driveway, put the pot on top of it, you know, tapped a few trees, filled it with sap. And then, you know, I remember the day they were out there. It was kind of fun. It was kind of a cold day in March, many, many years ago. It started to sort of spit snow and rain as it does still this time of year. And so I got the fire going. And of course, it was just an open fire, so there's all kinds of ash going up and falling back down into the pot. And they lasted maybe half an hour.
So, hello, what's your name?
Millie.
Millie, where are you from, Millie?
Texas.
Orno.
By way of Texas?
By way of Texas.
And so, is this your first time seeing how maple syrup is made?
Yes.
Did anything surprise you about the process?
Like you have to use fire.
Yes, you can't just take it right out of the tree, right?
Yeah.
Right. Anything interesting about the fire? What does the fire do? Do you know?
No.
When you cook the maple syrup, what does it do to it?
Does it take the water out of it? So it's more syrupy, right?
And then I sat there in brutal cold. The wind was blowing and boiled and boiled and boiled into the night. And then re-upped it the next day, finally got it down to, I think it was actually about half syrup, and it had all kinds of soot in it. And we took it in and had pancakes. So you would think that that would have quelled my syruping itch forever. But I don't tend to do things, you know, small, so... I told Gene later on in life after I retired that I was going to re-up my maple experience. I think I started it maybe in the, I bought a little hobby evaporator. I bought a kit online for a little sugar house. Well, I looked at them for years and they were pretty expensive. They were the kit, it was a 16 by 20 building. It had a little maple cupola on top. I just sort of dreamed about it because I think they were, the kit was like $11,000 and you had to get it there. I said, well, I can't afford that. So every now and then I'd go online and sort of dream about it. And I got a notice in the mail from them because I think I signed up for a newsletter. This little card came and it says, we're going to have a clearance sale. And I looked up that kit, which was, you know, it's the whole thing, a little timber frame with the metal roof and the doors come and all of it. And I thought it was a misprint, but it was $4,100.
From $11,000?
Yeah. So wow. I bought it. And it was a step up from before. I was dry. But we ended up with some real syrup. I guess learned the appreciation of watching sap boil.
That kind of like watching grass grow?
Yeah, kind of. But it, you know, the operation sort of grew. We started collecting food-grade buckets from various places. We tapped the tree, and we'd run a few lines from the trees into a five-gallon bucket. And if you fast-forward, the old evaporator got traded in for a much bigger one, which is what we've used the last few years. Then we also have a young man that works for us here at the farm, Corey Ames from the island, and he's certainly been a big help. When I was over at the legislature, it was awful hard. You know, we're getting to be a pretty good little operation. We made 22 gallons last year. We have a 300-gallon storage tank that we pump that's inside the sugar shack. And we collect that now in a 65-gallon tank that we pull behind a four-wheeler. At the same time, we, in those years, we hired a woodcutter who came in and removed some of the big oaks and big pines that needed to be thinned out. Mm-hmm. And so that helped, you know, thin some of that out and let the maples grow up.
How do you do it? How do you do your collections? Do you have the tubing and the, you said you had a pump, but do you do buckets and spiles or how do you do it?
Yeah, so we go to a tree and we have a two or three or four big trees that we'll put three taps in and we run those taps with the tubing into the bucket. We go through the top of the bucket. We drill a tight hole. So all we have to do is pull the top off and exchange buckets. And that three-tap tree on a sunny day will more than fill up. And we've now collected, we probably have 130 buckets. And we put in about 300 taps in about 100 and probably around 100 and 30 trees, I guess.
Wow, that's sizable.
And then they're strewn all over, but the woods are open so we can drive right up to most of the trees. We dump it into the 65-gallon tank. Mm-hmm. And on a really good day, we'll fill that up 3 to 4 times. So you have to get out there. But this one can burn off about 20 gallons an hour.
And so for a few frantic weeks, you're...
Yeah, and then there's a trick, which I didn't know about, and that's that the sap tends to once it's boiling vigorously, foams up and overflows. Well, the trick to that is they sell this stuff, but you can just take, we use sunflower oil. And if you drop two drops of that into the chamber, then it won't boil over. It just boils nice and even. And you can actually not stare at it for 12 hours straight.
Okay. Well, talk to me a little bit about sugaring in Maine and what makes it different from anywhere else in the Northeast or the North or the Great North or...
I know in Canada, you know, of course, in Quebec is the maple sugar capital of the world, and they actually control the industry there. They control how it all goes into some sort of central storage, and they let it out to maintain a balance of the price. And, of course, they had that thing that happened in 2011-12. I think there's a online TV show about it now called The Sticky, which was, there was a heist of some of that stored syrup, stolen 3,000 tons of it, $20 million worth of syrup over a few months. I don't know how it happened, but it's like sort of fascinating. Maine, I do know Maine is third in the country in production. I know that, I think last year they produced 575,000 gallons. While I was a legislator, I took a tour down to the Passamaquoddy tribe headquarters, the Wabanaki Center there. And they have quite an operation in Somerset County. It's part of their land that they bought. And I know it's called Passamaquoddy Maple. Mm-hmm. It's pretty fascinating. They told us about their operation. They have 14,000 taps, which isn't, you know, one of the biggest operations, because there's some in Maine that put out 100,000 taps. Of course, they're all tubed into straight into the tanks at the sugar houses. And sometimes those, I know the Passamaquoddy's told us some of their trees were a mile from the sugar house.
Wow, and that's a lot of.
They create a vacuum in their tubes so that it actually sucks more sap out of the tree.
Yeah, so Maine doesn't regulate it as tightly as Canada would, or
no? Canada's the only place that sort of tries to control the market a little, I guess.
It's more of a commodity there.
Yeah, big time. I think it's probably pretty similar in Vermont. I don't know. I think there's some maple sugaring that goes on in Michigan. John Paul Lalonde, who's from Michigan and lives in Bucksport, his family owns a plot in a sugar bush in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And he goes out there every month, the whole family does, and they produce syrup. They do more like 50 gallons.
Well, I know there's some sugaring in Wisconsin and also Minnesota. That would make sense. So how is Verona Island syrup different from Winterport syrup or whatever?
Well, it's better. No, I don't. You know, it's funny. I when I went down to talk to the kids, I just looked around to see if I could find some sort of information here and there. And I also have bees here. And I do think our honey is very, very distinct. And I think it's because of all the flowers Jean grows. And we have an old ancient ancestral apple orchard, too. I asked her the question last night. I said, which one is better for you, honey or maple syrup? What do you think the answer to that is?
I would say honey because of its antibiotic properties and so forth. But I don't know.
Well, it turns out if you're talking about a nutritional value, now, honey, you know, there's allergies and stuff. I guess it can help for local allergies. But what I read is that the maple syrup contains more minerals like manganese and riboflavin and zinc and antioxidants, which honey has too, antioxidants, but it doesn't have as many minerals. And then the sugar composition, which, remember, they're both basically got sugar in them. So you shouldn't use either one to excess. But the sucrose, which is easier on your metabolism than fructose, I guess it's called.
Fructose, yeah.
Fructose is higher in honey. So talking about the sugar content, the maple's better for you, and the more minerals is better for you. They're real close, but they gave in the glycemic index in maple syrup is lower than it is in honey.
So interesting.
According to that, maple syrup wins. So
maple syrup, the newest superfood.
I've read that the flavor of sugar maple syrup is better than red maple, but I would dare anybody test the two and see who would win with at least our red maple.
Well, I know that the terroir, if you will, of a place does influence the honey quite a bit. And I would imagine it would also influence the syrup. It has to do with the composition of the soil, maybe. And
yeah, I think so.
So who knows? But we'll just say Verona Island syrup is superior.
It's very good. I dare say anybody wants to come by and taste it, I'd love to have you sample it. Because, you know, giving it away is a chore because it's, you know, we're going to have like 400 bottles of syrup.
So, okay, well, that leads me to another question. If it's for sale or just for lucky friends and family?
Well, lucky friends and family. So here's another factoid I learned about maple syrup just the other day. Essentially, maple syrup happens at 7 degrees above the boiling point of water. So when you're boiling the sap and it gets through the different chambers and it moves on its own because it gets heavier as you boil it off. So it naturally follows this path where the lighter stuff pushes the heavier stuff. So it's 219 and then you take it off and you have maple syrup and you know, filter it and all that. If you take it to about 244 degrees, you can make maple sugar candy, and you can make it two ways. You can just get it to that temperature, pour it in a mold, and you'll have hard candy. Or you can add a little butter, and you'll have a creamy candy. So then if you keep going and you boil it to 262 degrees, and when it gets there, you got to get it off in a hurry, and you got to stir it while you're doing it. But you take it off, and you just vigorously stir it for a while, and you'll have granulated sugar. So generally, then people put it in a food processor and give it a couple of whacks, and it does. So the question is, if you have 12 ounces of syrup, how much sugar do you think you'll make? So this is the one that really gets people. You'll have 12 ounces of sugar.
Well, syrup still has water content, though, no?
It does at 266, but very little. And there's a little bit, and when you're beating it, it goes out. And then, of course, the granules have air around them, so they're going to take up space differently than liquid. The exact same amount, which is pretty interesting.
That's crazy. All right. Well, I think that's the sweetest science experiment you can have. This is great. I so appreciate your time.
I'm at the Back Ridge Sugar House today. It's Sunday. It's about 20 degrees cooler than it was yesterday. And I'm here with some guests from outside of Maine who are somewhat new to the maple sugaring discussion. And I'm going to ask them a couple of questions. Tell me your name, please.
My name is Darcy.
Darcy, where are you from?
Miami Beach, Florida.
Oh my, you can't get much different, can you? So welcome to Maine, first of all. And second of all, what do you think of this process? Have you ever seen how it's done before?
Never seen it, and I find it so fascinating that you actually can tap into a tree, get sap out of it, and it ends up on your kitchen table.
Deliciously.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Have you ever seen like the Currier and Ives prints where they have the little spile in the bucket and it drip, drip, drips? It's a very different situation now.
It's called modern technology.
Absolutely. Anything surprise you?
Yes, that there's nothing actually added to the product. That it boils down until it crystallizes or they get rid of the water, and it's pure maple syrup. So that's really what amazes me.
And it's got great staying power. It doesn't need preservatives or anything else.
Absolutely. You look at the ingredients as compared to when you go to Hannaford's or you go to Shaw's, and you see that it's totally different. They put additives in their product, and here there are none whatsoever. It's 100% Maine maple syrup.
You bet. And local. Very local.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Darcy. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Welcome, Julia Bousma, to Creative Maine. I am so honored to have you on the program. Julia is the Poet Laureate of Maine, so we are really thrilled to have her. Can you discuss what it means to be the Poet Laureate of Maine?
Absolutely, yes. So my job is basically, it's an honorary role to be Poet Laureate of Maine and to represent poetry and poems within our state. So I try to do as much as I can to support other Maine poets and poetry projects and things that are happening in the state, as well as design my own poetry projects. And I also do a lot of public speaking, driving around to libraries, which I love because I'm also a public librarian, and schools, and talking to people about poetry and really just helping poetry be a part of our daily lives and to celebrate the poems in Maine.
That's incredible.
In any ways as I can. Yeah.
What a wonderful position to have. I imagine as a poet, that's something tremendous to have achieved. So tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. What path does a librarian from the mountains of Maine travel to become Poet Laureate?
Sure. Well, I don't know. I think that poetry is, it's kind of about just creating your own path in many ways, or figuring out what works for you. And I do live in the mountains of Western Maine on the border of Franklin and Somerset counties on a piece of land that's, it's called Malay Hill where I live. And it actually, the paternal great grandmother of Edna St. Vincent Millay is buried in a small cemetery on the land up here. But I would say that my relationship to the land really informs a lot of my practice in poetry. I've lived in this part of Maine for the last 20 years, and up on this land, on Malay Hill, well, since 2008. So yeah, it's a big part of my practice. We have kind of a homesteader lifestyle. So sugaring right now, we're in the middle of that. And then, you know, raising pigs most summers. We've taken a break the last couple of years. Big vegetable gardens, chickens, you know, splitting all my own firewood and things like that. So, it's a big part of it. Helps keep me kind of connected. And I often feel like I'm writing poems in my head while I'm working with my hands.
Sorry, we have this 19th century.
A 19th century, yeah.
Kind of vision, yeah, of what a poet should be, you know, a guy in a smoking jacket with a, you know, and to think of you splitting logs and raising pigs, it's a different vision, which is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, my version of poetry definitely involves Carhartts and buckets. but I would say, you know, it's also an approach. My understanding of poetry is that poetry is all about connection. And so with that in mind, I love to wear a lot of different hats and do a lot of things. So I'm a librarian. I'm a poet. I teach classes here and there, and sometimes more formally than other times. I do editing work. I'm always trying to do as many things as possible. And I do feel like poetry is in many ways a community undertaking. So that makes sense to me.
Wow. Okay. So can you explain a little about what makes poetry different from prose? Is it rhythm? Is it rhyme? Is it just feelings? What would you say denotes? Because, you know, poetry isn't doggerel, you know. It's not like the end of every sentence has to rhyme. And how would you define it?
Yeah, I would say I think that poems are trying to use language in as many dimensions as possible at any one time. So I would say I think that, right, we're trying to use the sound of words, of course, what words we choose. Every word we choose so carefully because we're thinking about all the associations that that word has for us, and all, which includes the sonics of it. How does it sound? How does it feel in our mouth to say it? Mm-hmm. What are the different forms of poems we can use, and how can we create an organic container with the form for the words we're trying to say? What does the poem look like on the page? You know, what is the tension between the where the poem breaks its line and where the sentence ends naturally? All of these things are different dimensions that we can add to shape language in a way that prose is working, you know, toward a much larger picture. And we're really trying to stay in a moment and move around little pieces of time, in a sense.
Oh, that's beautifully put. I would never have thought of putting it that way. That's wonderful. What is the nature of it that draws us in? It's the shape in our mouths and the tension that we feel. Why can it be healing force and a cathartic means of expression?
I think it's helpful to me to understand the poem first and foremost as an emotive time, because a lot of people are uncomfortable with poetry. It's been taught to them in a way in school that really focused on the meaning of the poem. So this idea that a poem is this secret code and only some of us are smart enough to unlock it and figure out what the poet actually meant, which as a poet, I can say, is not a way that we want our poems to be thought about, really. I don't care if people know exactly what was in my head when I was writing a poem. In fact, sometimes I probably don't want them to know that, you know, but I do want them to connect with it emotionally. So if I'm writing a poem about something, you know, Sam writing a poem, I don't know, about baseball, and you read this poem and you used to go with your father to baseball games, and now your father has passed away. And so now you're reacting emotionally to this poem. That to me is where poetry happens, right? In that space between the reader and the writer. Mm. So it doesn't matter if we're just bringing ourselves to the poem as readers, and the poet's bringing themselves there as writers, and we meet somewhere in between in that space.
Mm-hmm. I know that as a nation, we were all transfixed by Amanda Gorman. She brought poetry to people who maybe had never, ever heard it before at the inauguration of President Biden. And I think that was a watershed moment for poetry because people felt a lot listening to her poems, and they didn't necessarily understand every allusion she was making.
Right. Right. And that makes sense to me, right? Because a lot of times we feel strongly before we know why we feel the things we feel. Right. So I think poetry can give us that opportunity for that intense, strong emotion. And then we can go back and we can say, well, what is the poem doing with language that's helping me feel the way I feel? Hmm. Right. And the more you study poetry, the more you learn what those tools and tricks are, and you can identify them. But first and foremost, you just let it wash over you. You feel poetry physically. And that's why there's that quote, I think, by Emily Dickinson about, you know, if I feel the top of my head lift off, I know it's poetry. Or I'm totally mangling the quote. But that feeling that you feel first in your body when you are really moved by a poem, mm-hmm. and then sort of outward into your thought. But first, you can often feel it very physically because that's really what we're going for, is that language that will be powerful in a kind of primal way.
Oh. So if you were teaching us all in a poetry writing situation, what advice or suggestions would you give for getting started in expressing yourself in that way? Do you start by jotting down just single words that maybe express something you want to say? Or how would you go about getting off square one?
I mean, I often come to the page and just free write and just, you know, whatever comes into my head, I just put it down on the page. And then I see what I like. I see how to shape it from there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes a poem just starts popping into my head fully formed. It really depends. You know, I think one thing that I would tell people is you learn to listen to the poem itself and not your idea of the poem. So once the poem really starts going, you're in service to that poem. And it may not be the poem you sat down to write. It may be a poem that wants to write itself, but you have to sort of learn to listen to it. The other piece of advice I would give is just to not be afraid. In fact, to give yourself permission to write bad poems, because it is not possible to write good poems without first writing bad poems. And, you know, so many of us don't like to make mistakes, but there's the only way to grow as a poet is to just be willing to take risks. Mm-hmm. So I often, you know, at a certain point, it does matter to think about my audience, but I often like to begin by pretending that no one will ever read the poems I'm writing, because I want to be my bravest self on the page and take risks.
Sort of a Dear Diary situation.
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, sometimes that's the way. And then later you go, okay, I want to publish this. I could think about that. But that's the editorial voice later. But to just get yourself going.
Who's to say what's a bad poem, I guess?
Exactly. It's all subjective. It's all subjective. And I shouldn't say bad. I should say a poem that is not fully realized.
Oh, that's,
you know, with many of my poems, they don't end up fully realized, but I keep all of my drafts and I save them for later. And often a poem that couldn't find its form 2 years ago finally finds it 2 years later, you know? So
sure. Do you think you could honor us with a reading of a poem?
Sure. I thought I would read a poem to you from my book, Death Fluorescence, which is coming out in June. And given that we're just wrapping up sugaring season here and that the rest of the episode is about sugaring, I will read this poem, Sugaring at the Start of Another War. And this begins with an epigraph by Thomas Jefferson. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure. This year, it's all melt and bleed. The moon hemorrhages through the branches, dancing out of season with her red frock. And we know what it means. When the world around you is dying, practice with your hands. Dress for combat. It's time to tap the trees again. Time to hang the buckets for the sweet letdown. You drill the maples. I hammer spiles into fresh wounds. The trees spout. They mouth drip. It's nothing new. This brew we boil of our collective sorrow. We do it every spring. But this year, I am measuring dread more precisely than before. Now I am all metaphor and chewed lips, a sleepless anxiety that coils and recoils my skin, finds me trembling in the strangest places. The dentist chair, for example, where she bends toward my open mouth, smiles, and sweetly declares, we're stockpiling guns. When the time comes, we'll be ready to fight. We just don't know how yet or whom. She switches the Dremel on, metal whine hungry as a swarm, and grinds the stain from the backs of my teeth. Everyone here is gingerly unspooling risk. All of us trying on words in secret. Underground Railroad, soldier, fascism, courage, refuse. Inherited language as suddenly alien as unlabeled boxes in a dead grandmother's closet. Ornate Cyrillic carved into a samovar's golden flourish, the unknown ancestor who scowls through beard and fez at the photographer's lens. An amateur oil painting of a woman stooped before her hoe to the work of the field. None of us understands what it means, but we bend throat to throat with the trees and drink hard, pull away and watch the sap spill out over our palms. We all know it runs clear every spring until it doesn't. Even those of us who don't believe in fear or souls, remember there's sugar in blood.
Ooh. No words. Thank you. That's wonderful. So this is a book coming out in June. And yes. Tell us again the name of it.
It's called Death Fluorescence.
And who's the publisher?
It's by Sundress Publications.
Okay. Where else can our listeners find you in the meantime?
Sure. Well, I post events. I'm out and about all over the place. I've got a lot of events in April and a few in May, but I will be, you can find all of that information on my website, www.juliabousma.com, and the Maine Arts Commission also on their Poet Laureate page has an out and about that lists my schedule as well.
Fantastic. I really, really am honored to have you on the show. It was a wonderful interview. Thank you so very much. And good luck with the rest of your year as Poet Laureate. Is 1 year or more?
I have one more year. Yes, it's a 5-year term, but I'll be done in the summer of 2026.
Very exciting. Congratulations. And I hope to speak with you again.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for having me.
Thank you so much to my delightful guests, Ron Russell, Jason Lilly, and Julia Bousma. Our theme music is composed and performed by Ariel Chapman. If you have questions or comments for me or any of our guests, please send them to info@weru.org. Please write Creative Maine in the subject line. Please join Creative Maine at WERU 89.9 FM or on weru.org for another eclectic episode on Thursday, May 15th at 4 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time, when we will learn about becoming a writer in spite of oneself. Thank you so much for listening. This is Adina Salmonson wishing you a wonderful month of the arts and crafts that enrich your life and bring you joy.